Greetings, everyone. It is now time for Marked Safe. Tales of your very favorite and most beloved disasters. On Marked Safe, we discuss events and details that some may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. Please listen responsibly and stay safe. And now, here with your hosts, Brianne and Melanie, this is Marked Safe.
Jojo, have you learned nothing?
No, absolutely not a word. I've done this for, what, has it been 3 years now? Four? Yeah. Oh, God, has it been 4 years?
Are we coming up on?
I believe we are. It's been almost 4 years talking about disasters, telling you guys everything I know about disasters, picking up quite a few safety tips concerning disasters, but you can't take the Indiana out of a girl.
And you could take the girl out of Indiana, apparently.
But, I mean, apparently you could suck her up and drop her in Kansas. I don't know. Indiana got hit pretty hard with tornadoes since we last recorded. I am completely fine, but my dumb, stupid ass, and I'm calling myself out here so that you guys cannot do this, although you're probably all too smart to do this. My dumb, stupid, desensitized to tornadoes ass was like, oh, there's a tornado watch? But it's over, like, the whole state, and it's, like, all day. I mean, that's... Okay, so the weather's right for a tornado. You don't just stay home because the weather's right for a tornado. Like, in Indiana, you don't do that. So I'm like, it's fine. I can run a little errand, like, 20, 30 minutes north of here. It'll be fine. It wasn't fine. It wasn't fine.
You had me worried.
It had me a little tripped out, to be honest. I think that's... I don't know. There's probably been 5 storms in my whole life that have kind of made me a little sweaty in the palms, and that was probably one of them. Driving through the spooky, well, riding, I didn't have to drive, riding through the spooky clouds, looking up the fucking sunroof, looking for tornadoes up there, had to stop and shelter twice because the alarms went off. The sirens went off. Lesson learned. Should have already been learned long before that even happened, but, apparently, Indiana for 36 years versus thinking about disasters all the time for 4 has not translated to common fucking sense for me.
Maybe next you're time. Desensitized.
I mean, honestly, that is what it is. I wouldn't have gone out if it was a tornado warning. I'm not a complete idiot, but I'm like, okay, so the weather's right for a tornado. Okay, that's going to be half the spring. We can't stay home the whole time. That one wasn't joking, though. Damn.
Yeah, you had to stop at a store, right?
Two different stores. Two. Yeah. It was unsettling and not as fun as you might think.
I'm like, give me your location. So Brianne's like pinning her location and sharing it with me. And then, you know, Cody has access to like the super weather Doppler stuff because of his job. And I'm like, here she is. Check on her.
Which was super helpful because then I knew that it wasn't really that close. We did have sirens in the area that I was in more than once. But I mean, apparently, I don't think that there was any major touchdown in the area that I actually was. But I also didn't anticipate having to pull over more than one time on the way home.
It was squirrely. I didn't like it.
To be honest, I didn't either. And I usually love that shit, but it was a bit much. It was a bit much. So, yeah, here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are.
Safe and
learn
sound.
Learn from me. Don't do that, guys. So, how are you this week?
I'm good. It's been busy. Aria had her 9th birthday. It was a lot of fun. We had, we went bowling, which is, you know, her favorite thing lately. Josie started flag football. That was exciting. Ava had her competition recently with archery, which was a whole nother thing. And I don't know. I have managed to jam pack us with a lot more stuff this summer. I went from last year doing hardly anything to this year. My kids are going to hate me. we got.
Or are you?
I'm doing it to myself, I guess. It's my own.
It's never stopped me.
Tornado warning that I'm not listening to.
Right.
So we've signed up for softball and t-ball. Josie will still have football on top of that. They're also signed up for swim team. And last minute, just saw that our local theater is doing a kids camp. So the girls are signed up for that too, for SpongeBob the Musical.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah. And Ava wants to audition for Pearl the Whale. So we've been listening to that daddy song on repeat.
I don't think I know it.
It is something. Cody got home from work and he's like, "What's going on?" And Ava's like, "I'm not calling for you, daddy. I'm just practicing. You're just going to have to know the difference. If I'm singing it, it's not for you."
Wow.
So,
wow. Yeah. I need to listen to the daddy song.
Yeah. Well, should we jump into our new bracket?
Oh, I hope it's not one that I was supposed to prepare for this week, but let's do it. Hopefully, I think the first two are easy ones, aren't they?
The first two are easy. We will announce the winner next week. It's like I said, we've been a little busy, so we will go through that. We like to triple check it. And I know there was a snafu on last one where I put two, or I said one was a winner and it wasn't, but you clarified that it wouldn't have mattered. So.
No.
We're gonna.
I'm happy to put that to rest.
So, we are starting the sandwich bracket, which is really exciting.
Okay, so I think that the approachability of this one has my girlfriend very dedicated to making sure that I actually try everyone on this, which I have not done with any previous food bracket.
Okay, so
I've done what I could, but I haven't taken it that seriously with previous food
brackets. I was hoping she'd kind of jump in on this because she's a bit of a foodie.
She is very much a foodie, yes. And she really did carry the team in the last bracket and encouraged me to eat a lot of seafood that I would never otherwise eat and will never eat again. I believe, our first real date actually was because of the seafood bracket. And I think our second too. So this one hopefully will be less horrifying, but I do think that we have her support in... is it even support for me? I think that she plans to harass me into doing this whether I want to or not.
Okay, well, so. that's good to know because now I can message her about that. So I will...
Yeah, she's already been finding local restaurants that have ones that she knows I have probably not tried. She's got a brunch planned out. Yeah.
We got to get some Vegemite your way. I intentionally put that towards the back end because I didn't know how easy it would be to get it for you. So we have to... jump on this now. Get you some.
Torn the back end is where that belongs.
It's so good, though. You have to do it the right way.
What's the right way? Pray tell.
Well, you cannot just smear it like peanut butter. It's like a seasoning.
Like a spread more?
Lighter than that.
Okay.
Lighter than that.
We'll talk about this when we get near the back end.
I actually think you'll love it. I think you'll love it.
You know, I will say... I am a picky eater, but an adventurous picky eater in the sense that I will technically try a lot of weird things that I don't think I'll like. I probably don't won't like it because my success rate is not the best in terms of liking new foods, but I am very willing to try them. So I'm going to be adventuresome in the sandwich bracket. Throw it at me.
Okay, so this week we're starting off with two classics, very easy, one very cheesy. Grilled cheese versus peanut butter and jelly.
That's, first of all, not very adventuresome. Second of all, this is so much harder than it sounds because both of those for me are like, I don't like it that often, but now and then, like they're in the exact same category for me.
They're childhood staples for me.
I had a pretty good amount of... peanut butter and jelly as a child. So definitely peanut butter and jelly needs to be cheap white bread extra crunchy peanut butter and the closest thing to just sweetened chunks of strawberries I can reasonably get out of a jam.
Oh, it sounds so good.
It is so good. It is tits. I will say, even then, I want it maybe once a year, twice is pushing it. Grilled cheese, I also never cook it because I fuck it up, and a lot of times it is just too much. It's too heavy. I'm not a fan. However, I had grilled cheese and tomato soup like a week ago. Melanie, that shit was fire.
It's the best.
It was fire, and I want it right. You know what? Grilled cheese.
Grilled cheese.
Grilled cheese, because honestly, if they were in front of me right now, I'd pick a grilled cheese. Normally, I think I would have picked peanut butter and jelly based on accessibility alone, because it's easier to make, because somehow, easy as they may be, I fuck up grilled cheese every time.
How?
I don't know why. I don't know. Like, I don't. It's just never quite right.
You just spread, spread a little bit of mayonnaise on before you fry the bread.
You know what? I'm aware that mayonnaise can be used as a substitute to butter, and I'm not going to take the bait that you're trying to get me to take right now.
Oh, girl. Listen to me.
I know things. I have had children. I have been alive for decades. I have made grilled cheese many times. And every time I say, Brie, what the fuck? You cook harder things than this all the time, and it turns out okay. And you have fucked up another grilled cheese. What is wrong with you? So for that reason alone, I think I normally would have picked peanut butter and jelly. But however, guess who made the grilled cheese last week that was so fire?
Your girlfriend.
Bingo. She's perfect grilled cheese maker. Oh. So grilled cheese.
You know what? You know what? I'm really excited about this bracket too. I want to learn a couple things.
What do you want to learn?
One, how do you prefer your bread toasted? Like, I need to know the color. Isn't there a chart we can post in Horrible Ghouls?
Yes, there is. You know, if you're just roughly saying 1 is practically raw bread and 10 is just black, generally I'm somewhere in the 3 to 5 range.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah.
And then how do you...
I don't like it overly toasted.
How do you eat the sandwich? Like, do you just eat it normal?
Oh, no.
Do you nibble the crust and leave the center?
It depends on the sandwich. I do think that I'm a less high-maintenance sandwich bite planner than a person would expect me to be, because I am such a pain in the ass in almost every area of my life. I feel like I'm going to start with a corner, and, you know, it's one of those things where I'm not sure I could describe to you the correct sequence of sandwich bites, but my heart knows. My intuition knows. If I have a sandwich in my hand and you say, take a bite of the wrong piece, that's going to feel so wrong. But, you know... Why do that? Just live and let live. Let people bite their sandwiches in any order they want.
Absolutely not.
Of cocaine. Go on. I knew you were going to be like this. Tell me your sandwich feelings.
I mean, you have to save the best for last.
Yes, but I don't think I agree on what is the best, because I think everyone thinks that basically the center bite is best, and I disrespectfully disagree.
Is it too much for your mouth?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It is too much for my mouth. Let me tell you the perfect bite of a sandwich, okay? So picture this. You got a sandwich. Who knows what's in it? Let's say it's a square and it is comprised of various vegetables and a meat base and some sauce, okay? Let's say that. So you have the sandwich. Let's say it's a square. You want to nibble what is basically the crust for a few bites. And then the next bite, where it's like a little bit of empty bread, but the beginning of all of the toppings, that's the bite.
You're wrong.
No, you're wrong.
we probably should get into this episode before we break up. Jesus.
Okay. I don't think I want to know your psychopath sandwich ways.
Oh, it was so cute. I gave Squonk a string cheese yesterday, and Cody was like, oh, wow, he doesn't even, like, pull the strings off. He just eats it like you.
Are you kidding me? You made another one like you?
I did. Isn't it adorable?
Melanie, I blocked that out about you. Which child did you say this is, Squonk?
Squonk.
Of course it is. The delinquent. I could have known that. That's an early warning sign. They need to put that on the FBI's website.
Well, he may be young, but he knows how to eat a sandwich, too.
No. No. He may be young, but he knows how to be a psychopath like his mom.
All right, what do you got for me this week? I know what you got for me.
You do. I hope we've enjoyed all our laughing and all our whimsical sandwich conversation. And I hope that anyone else who was hoping that we rushed through the intro is sorry now.
This one is a rough one.
I hyper-focused on this more than most that I have done. And when we got to the end and it was time to record, and Squonk wouldn't sleep because he just wanted to get up and eat a cheese stick the wrong way. At that time, I was so obsessed with this story that I'm like, okay, so we're not recording an episode, but let me tell you some stuff.
Yes. I've got an inbox full of photos.
Yes. And they are dark. And I can't discourage you enough from looking those up. Yeah, what no one knows is that whenever we're like, and this is a detail I've chosen to omit because it's too dark, we're immediately in each other's inboxes like, and this is what it was.
Yes.
Immediately, every time.
If I have to see it, you have to see it too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is why we're besties. Okay.
I always feel like I've really accomplished something when we get down to recording and you don't know what my topic is. So I killed that this time, unfortunately. I wanted a classic disaster because I felt like we've done a few that were a little off the beaten path, which is fine and fun and great. But I was like, you know what? Let's do a classic disaster. I'm feeling like a plane crash. Let's look for a record-setting plane crash. And oh my lord. Oh my lord, it's dark. So, let's go. But first, a drink.
Oh yeah.
Did you say, oh yeah, all excited about a drink?
Yeah, I love it.
I'm leaving that in because that was cute. You're like, oh, yeah. Why are you so excited about it? I love you.
Because it's like, I didn't realize I was thirsty until you told me. I'm very codependent, I guess.
That's okay. I hope that you enjoyed it. The drink and the codependency.
You quench my thirst.
That's what she said. So... in the 1980s, the market for commercial planes looked a little bit different in Japan than in a lot of other countries. Most of the world in aviation was focusing on getting planes to go really long distances as fuel efficiently as possible. Japan also needed to get very large volumes of people shorter distances away very frequently. Distances that we would most likely just drive in the US or a lot of European countries, but the entire country is the size of Montana, about 150,000 square miles, and 2/3 of that terrain is mountainous. So there are some unique aviation and transport needs in the region. As it was, Japan tended to use large 747s for internal flights, which airlines in most countries didn't. And it still didn't meet the demand. So the Boeing 747 SR was developed. SR stood for short range, featuring a condensed seating layout with, it's really hard to find specifics on this, but it appears to me that there's an upper deck that can be accessed by a spiral staircase, which is cool as shit.
Sounds fancy.
Right? And reinforced landing gear to handle the impact heavy, frequent touchdowns made by a heavier plane running short-haul flights. So not only is the plane heavier, so the landing gear needs to be sturdier, but it's also landing all the time because it's doing these short-haul domestic flights. Of course, people like us have to imagine that when these types of planes hit the market, somewhere in the abyss, Grim Reaper is rubbing his bony hands together, looking at the standing record for the most fatalities in a single plane crash, which at the time was Turkish Airlines Flight 981, 1974, 336 fatalities, and doing his best Matthew McConaughey impression, saying, you gotta pump those numbers up. Those are rookie numbers. 7 years prior to our story, a 4-year-old Boeing 747 SR suffered something called tail strike, which is pretty much what it sounds like. I'm sure you already know. It bonked its booty while it was landing. And I say that,
bogged its booty.
I say that whimsically because, God, we need it somewhere in this story. But it wasn't minor. There were actually 25 injuries. 2 were serious, although I couldn't find a whole lot of information on what types of injuries. But the damage to the plane was not insubstantial either. It was removed from service to be repaired, including repairs to the rear pressure bulkhead. Now, when you're picturing that, picture a dome on its side that separates the pressurized cabin from the not pressurized tail. The airline didn't even have the ability to fix such severe damage, so they hired a repair team from Boeing. After being essentially stabilized, the plane was placed on a ferry to be taken to a heavy construction facility where over 3 weeks the plane, quote, underwent intensive reconstruction.
Oh, it's like an operation.
Yeah. You don't really want a plane that's undergone intensive reconstruction, necessarily.
No.
But somebody made a mistake. A very consequential mistake. Part of the bulkhead was supposed to be held on with two rows of rivets, but it only had one.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think it would be too complicated to translate well to a podcast format if I got into detail about exactly what went wrong, because personally, I needed several diagrams to get my head around it. But basically, they got to the end of a repair and they realized they didn't have enough material left. Like if you're sewing and you get to the end and there's not room on both sides to connect your stitches. Basically, they got there, they realized they didn't have enough material left. There wasn't room for the second row of rivets to go. So they came up with a complicated workaround. And then they fucked up the workaround.
Mm.
So we'll get into that in a little bit more detail later. But trying to fix this bulkhead, they've somehow miscalculated. And they figured out a fix, which they then incorrectly implemented. Person who inspected it missed the error because it was hidden by a component of itself. Plane was returned to service, but what no one knew was that the stress of this incorrect distribution of pressure was slowly creating cracks around the bulkhead. Tiny, tiny cracks. But every single flight, the process of pressurizing the cabin strained them more. The bulkhead had to withstand a force comparable to, quote, a simultaneous punch by a couple hundred super heavyweight boxers, end quote, every time the plane was pressurized.
Mm.
In August of 1985, that plane was now 11, and it had flown without incident for 7 years since its major reconstruction. And Japan was celebrating Obon, a few-day-long holiday when Japanese people travel to their family homes to honor and connect with their ancestors, so travel systems were beyond congested. And also, while we're thinking about this, I would like to know why our culture doesn't really, that I can think of, have any widely recognized day to remember the dead. Like, that sounds like a great idea. A lot of other cultures do. We don't have, like, a dead people holiday. We should get one.
White people are boring.
I mean, honestly, like, a lot of cultures have some kind of, you know, there's Day of the Dead, there's Obon, there's a lot of things where you somehow commemorate people who are gone, and we really don't have anything comparable.
No, I mean, I think that does speak to the American culture. I mean,
oh, for sure.
It's very, life is for the living.
Yeah. Well,
who cares?
I think we need to come up with one.
I agree. No, I agree. I'm not
I know.
Raining on your parade. It's
just, no, I know.
It makes sense why we don't. But
I know. I agree. It does, but I wish we did.
Let's make
without
our own.
Appropriating somebody else's, because I'm like, hold up, this is smart, but we can't just get involved with somebody else's stuff. We need something. I don't know. Maybe the ghouls can work on this.
A little poker day.
Wait, what?
Poker with Papaw.
Oh, Prankster Papaw Day.
Yes.
Hey, now. Hold on, you can be on to something. Okay. So, hold on, now I've got ideas. Okay, this is not the time for ideas.
You know, we can make our own holiday. Like, you can
You've been trying for years.
I know. They have not, like, given me my National Vienna Sausage Day yet.
And
maybe
God.
I just need
they
to,
don't
like,
need to embolden you in that way.
Workshop it. To
okay,
Prankster Papaw Poker Day with a side of Vienna sausages. That could be like the you know.
I think we can spend some more time on R&D for this.
Okay. I guess.
Before we throw Vienna sausages down this hallway. We'll work on it, Melanie.
Throw me this sausage.
I love callbacks so much. Oh, okay. Hope that was fun. So, Japan Airlines Flight 123 was scheduled to take 509 passengers and 15 crew the 250 or so miles from Tokyo to Osaka on the plane that had been repaired 7 years ago.
That is a packed flight. That is a lot of people.
It is a lot of people. On board, 503 out of them were Japanese, along with one from China, one from the UK, two from West Germany, two from Italy, three from India, three from South Korea, four from British Hong Kong, and six from the United States. 12 passengers were infants. The crew included Captain Takahama, First Officer Sasaki, and a flight engineer. The first officer sat in the captain's seat because he was in training to be a captain. So we get passenger profiles from various sources on a small handful of passengers. At least one passenger, a finance guy named Akihisa, had woken up with a strong disinclination to board the flight that day. His partner of 8 years, who was 9 months pregnant, talks about him trying to take a bullet train in hopes of avoiding the plane, but the train was full. He flew every couple weeks, but there was just something about this one, he was dreading it. In the back of the plane, Yumi was a 26-year-old newlywed flight attendant who loved travel, loved her job, but she was not on board in a working capacity. Like a lot of other people, she was traveling to see her family for the holiday. So she settled into the flight with a magazine seated four rows from the back, and we will hear much more about her later. The 54-minute flight departed at 6:12 p.m. It quickly reached cruising altitude of 24,000 feet, and the route would go just off the mainland. It would fly most of its route over the Pacific Ocean and then turn back onto the mainland at the very end. A little over 10 minutes into the flight, as they reached cruising altitude, the black box picked up a flight attendant coming up to tell the cabin crew that a passenger was asking to use the bathroom before the seatbelt light had gone off and ask if it was okay to let him, which was a super common question. Cabin crew said yes to the request, but before the passenger could get to the bathroom, 12 minutes into the flight, a loud bang could be heard throughout the plane, and it rocked violently. The bulkhead that had held for 7 years had failed, the one that had been held on with one row of rivets rather than two. This flight was finally randomly the straw that broke the stress fracture's backs. The bulkhead had torn off, and so had the ceiling above the bathrooms. Quote, once it opened up, air rushed into the back of the 747 with so much force that it ripped off the aircraft's tail cone at the back of the fuselage, where an airplane's sensitive avionics are housed. The burst tore away the jet's auxiliary power unit and a major portion of its vertical stabilizer pin, including the rudder. Most critically, when the explosion had sheared off the rear of the plane, it severed all four hydraulic systems, which power the plane's rudder, ailerons, and other control surfaces. Without them, the massive jet was like a paper airplane on a gusty day, completely unresponsive to the pilot's steering commands. End quote. So, as this unfolded, very quickly, air traffic control, which here is called Tokyo Control, saw the indicator dot that was underneath each plane on their screen switch from green to red, indicating distress. Another perspective on the bang and immediate aftermath says, quote, a loud explosion rocked the plane, and a powerful wind tore loose everything that wasn't tied down, propelling papers and napkins and magazines back toward the hull as the inside and outside pressure violently equalized. Near the rear galley, ceiling panels tore themselves from their mountings and disappeared backward into the void. White fog suddenly filled the cabin as the water vapor in the air condensed instantaneously, end quote.
Wow.
Yumi, the off-duty flight attendant, said, at 18:25 p.m. there was a bam sound overhead. Then my ears began to hurt. I don't know if a door flew off or not. I did not hear any other explosion sound from the floor or anywhere else. At the same time, the air inside the cabin turned pure white. The plane began moving strangely, up and down, side to side. The pilot sent out a distress signal, and then they contacted Tokyo Control to declare an emergency and request permission to return to the airport they'd come from.
Ugh, they got it. I don't like that.
Requesting permission to return?
No, the way the plane is moving.
Oh, we're going to hear so much more about that. It's got names for that kind of movement. Yeah. So they got the okay to turn back, and Tokyo Control asked for more information on the nature of the emergency. But they could see on screen that the plane had not completed the turn needed to return to the airport. So they again asked what was wrong, and they got no response. Meanwhile, in the cabin, oxygen masks fell down from their compartments and alarms started. An automated message said, we are now flying in an emergency condition. Please put on the oxygen mask. Please fasten the seatbelt. Please extinguish all cigarettes. We are now flying in an emergency condition. Can you imagine how scary that would be? Right.
Yeah. Cigarettes. It's I totally forget, like, that was
a thing. It's wild. Yeah.
There was a smoking section in McDonald's and people could smoke on planes.
Uh-huh. So Tokyo Control had approved the return to the airport, but the turn had not been abandoned midway through intentionally. When the pilots tried to turn the plane, they found that it didn't respond, or it didn't respond enough. And that's when they realized they did not have, for the most part, control. Simple Flying said, it flew in a rather unorthodox manner, experiencing phenomena such as fugoid oscillations and Dutch rolls. So if you don't know, which I certainly did not know, Dutch rolls are not like barrel rolls, but they're more like a very wobbly zigzag. The fugoid effect is the process of high speed descent. So basically they're going way down, but then the speed and the descent causes them to lift back up again.
Yeah.
But they're not really lifting up under their own power. So as they're doing that, they're losing speed as they lift up. So they lift up, they lose speed, then they start descending fast. Then it makes them lift back up again, and so on and so forth. Medium wrote, the combined fugoid and Dutch roll caused the plane to fly like a ship on a storm-tossed sea, rising and falling, rolling and plunging, swaying back and forth as it staggered forward, unstable on every axis of motion. End quote. The modifications needed to interrupt a Dutch roll made a fugoid cycle worse. And the modifications needed to interrupt a fugoid cycle made a Dutch roll worse. So there was very little that they could do. There was very little they could do in general, but there were slight things they could do to help one or the other, but it made the other worse. So there wasn't really much they could do, but endure both simultaneously. Yumi may have been off duty, but she jumped into action to help the other passengers get their oxygen masks and life jackets on as soon as she had hers on. She worked in tandem with the on-duty flight attendants, and they got people into position for a crash landing. People grabbed papers and pens to write their families' messages. A 26-year-old wrote, I'm scared, I'm scared, I'm scared. Help, I feel sick, I don't want to die. Another wrote, to think that our dinner last night was the last time. Another wrote, there's little oxygen, I feel sick. Inside the plane, voices are saying, let's do our best. Another wrote, please look after the children. Oh. Another wrote, the plane is turning around and descending rapidly. I am grateful for the truly happy life I've enjoyed until now. He didn't get a note written during the flight, but the man who had tried so hard not to be on this flight with a wife who's 9 months pregnant had written her a note a week before that said, you never know how much I do love you. You are my treasure forever. Wherever I am, I'll always be with you. Yours. Whew. A lot of... Yeah. All that got me.
Yeah, that's really heavy.
Flight attendants tried to comfort them, and finally Yumi also assumed the brace position. She had seen the writing on the wall. She knew where the plane's path was taking it. Tokyo Control continued to try to identify what was happening, but their already extremely stressful jobs were complicated today because, again, all of Japan's travel systems were very overloaded with both evening rush and holiday travel. I mean, this is basically when work lets out before Memorial Day weekend kind of thing.
Right.
And the tension was very high at Tokyo Control. They felt like the pilots were trying to communicate in English, but struggling to keep up with their second language under the strain. So the air traffic controllers shifted the conversation into Japanese, but it didn't bring much clarity. Hypoxia was likely a factor already, because the cabin crew didn't respond to Tokyo Control asking about the nature of their emergency, but they could be heard talking to each other and just not understanding the situation. There was still some hydraulic fluid remaining in the systems, so the loss of control wasn't immediate and complete, and I think that probably added to their confusion, because the control was very, very quickly diminishing to nothing. And I think that they did not get their oxygen masks on fast enough, and at that point, hypoxia had greatly impaired their judgment. And we talked about this at length in the scuba diving episode, and probably the saturation diving episode. Problem with hypoxia is that the part of you that's impaired, your brain, your cognition, is the part of you that is required to function to save yourself.
Right.
You know, you're trying to walk home on a broken leg. And at the moment that you need quick, logical thinking, you're slow, you're muddled, disoriented, stubborn, missing obvious solutions. And it is so frustrating to think about because they were told to put on their oxygen masks more than once, and they acknowledged that by saying yes, but they didn't do it very likely because of the hypoxia.
Right.
The ability that they showed to troubleshoot their situation at certain times that coincided with hypoxia, it just wasn't congruent with their levels of skill and experience. And that's so sad. Their voices stayed clear enough in all the recordings that it can be inferred that they never did put their masks on. So, plane continued to lose parts and pieces midair. One article described this part of the flight as the plane disintegrating before impact. The cabin crew fought through the brain fog enough to tell Tokyo Control that they were flying without control, but they were confused enough to give their flight number as 124, which did seem to be understood. Tokyo Control asked, "Can you control now?" at 6:47 p.m., and the captain just said, "Uncontrollable." The pilots were so disoriented that they weren't sure at first if they were descending or not. The captain reported that the door was broken and, quote, "right now we're descending," but they weren't. Different articles said, "Still hurtling up and down between 20,000 and 22,000 feet, the plane strayed further and further inland, heading away from all major airports." The plane flew for 32 minutes without much control, but the crew... Yeah. That whole time... The crew fought for their lives and their passengers' lives trying to maintain control. And I think in this story in particular, it's sad how we end up focusing on the errors that were made as a result of hypoxia, because even in spite of that, their training and judgment did shine through. They had such limited options, but they tried so much in such bad conditions mentally, neurologically, from using thrust to adjust their ascent and descent, to lowering their landing gear to try to reduce the Dutch rolls, to struggling with controls until the literal last moment. A beautiful and horrible line from the Medium article about this, where I did get a lot of information, said, "Deprived of oxygen, their brain struggled to make sense of what was happening and what they needed to do about it. And for several minutes, they became little more than passengers, carried along by the cold laws of aerodynamics." The flight engineer suggested that they'd better descend, seemingly unaware that they had been desperately trying to descend. But then as they lost altitude, they gained oxygen. And they started operating on more cylinders and noticeably communicating better, which unfortunately meant realizing how dire things were. Because as this happened, the captain said, "This may be hopeless."
Oh, they snapped back into it.
Yep. So someone had to have been listening in on the air traffic control radio frequency and called the media, because there were eyes on the struggling plane while it was still in the air. And TV stations started interrupting their normal broadcast to cover the situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've been up there for a while.
They've been up there for 32 minutes without really control, and it was visible to a lot of people. A woman saw it in the air and said, "An aircraft flew over my house headed south. The aircraft was lower on the left side and appeared to be on the verge of falling." Maybe she was the one who called in. I don't think she was. A man spoke to a TV station as he watched the plane struggle near Mount Fuji. One person who saw it from the ground said the plane was moving like a staggering drunk. And it was staggering terrifyingly close to the mountains. The captain yelled, "Hey, mountain, turn right, mountain, take control, right turn, we'll hit a mountain, max power." And they got the plane up a little, but at the cost of a lot of momentum. And their stall warning went off. The captain said, "Oh no, stall, max power, max power." And the captain ordered the first officer, rev up," telling him to apply power to the engine to try to get them clear of the mountains. He could be heard yelling, "Power, power, raise the nose, raise the nose, raise it," but it didn't work. At a certain point, the pilot stopped engaging with Tokyo Control, probably understanding that this was going to come down to a fight for focus and control rather than anything that could really be guided by them. And the focus would probably help them more than anything going on with Tokyo Control at this point. You have to assume that that's probably why they stopped interacting with them too much toward the end. Plane suddenly plunged toward the ground, and Yumi said it felt like they were going straight down. The right wing hit a ridge in the mountainside at an altitude of 5,000 feet, tipping it sharply to the right. A lot of the peaks at that point were higher than 5,000 feet, so they're in extreme danger at that point. Yeah. A later report would say that the wing, quote, "was shattered to such an extent that it retained no resemblance to its original form." The alarm for the ground proximity warning system began to go off. The captain yelled, "It's the end." And then, quote, "debris tumbled down the mountainside as the wing disintegrated, but the 747 kept going. rolling over onto its back as it hurtled more than 500 meters across a ravine. Finally, the jet slammed upside down into the spine of yet another ridge, obliterating much of the aircraft in an enormous explosion that could be seen for miles. Huge pieces of the plane rolled down the steep slope into the ravine, knocking over trees and scattering burning debris over a vast area of ruined forest. After 32 minutes of terror, Japan Airlines Flight 123 was down. End quote. Tokyo Control saw the plane disappear from their radar on impact, hundreds of miles off course from their original route by that point. A seismometer at a nearby earthquake observatory picked up both the initial impact and the final impact and explosion. 1 minute later, a Japanese military plane reported a fireball in the mountains. Yumi, the off-duty flight attendant, had survived the impact, and now she felt a few aftershocks. The air was oppressive between the jet fuel, smoke, dust, and debris. She said, "After the crash, I heard harsh panting and gasping noises from many people. I hear it coming from everywhere, all around me. There was a boy crying mother. I clearly heard a young woman saying, 'Come quickly.' Suddenly, I heard a boy's voice. 'Okay, I'll hang on,' he said. In the darkness, I could hear the sound of a helicopter. I couldn't see any light, but could hear the sound, and it was quite near, too. 'We will be saved,' I thought, and I waved frantically. But the helicopter went further away. 'Don't go,' I waved desperately. 'Help,' but it faded. I could no longer hear the voices of the boy or the young woman." Through the night, the sounds that Yumi heard of the survivors faded. 20 minutes after impact, an American plane spotted the wreckage and reported it. There are a lot of reports that the Air Force offered a helicopter that would be able to descend immediately and that they were turned down.
Who reported that?
It's controversial, but I don't think... I don't know. I like to assume that the U.S. is full of shit. And I like to assume, because it's generally true, that we like to come in with a cowboy hero complex.
Yeah.
And thinking we could have saved the day if only someone had let us. I've read a lot of things on both sides of this. Personally, I think I'm inclined to believe this one, but you gotta filter it through the American bullshit filter.
Right.
So I don't know. Do with that what you will. Nobody initially thought that anybody could have or would have survived. So not necessarily any reason to involve others like that when the locals could organize a recovery mission. There had been multiple flyovers. Nobody was reporting any signs of life at all. Quote, the report claimed that by 9:05 p.m., which this happened at like 7 or so, a helicopter was already hovering over the crash site with two Marines ready to rappel down to the wreckage, only to be called back to base as the Japanese were said to be on their way. Although the story is often repeated in English language media, it has never been independently verified. However, the key factor in the decision to delay the rescue appears to have been the C-130 crew's statement that they didn't think there were any survivors. Believing there to be no particular urgency to get to the scene, Japanese authorities allegedly preferred to avoid the image of a foreign military being their first to respond to a domestic disaster. I don't know.
I mean, maybe.
I mean, we'll never know, but I hope not. That sucks. The crash site was a very remote and difficult to access mountain range. In heavy rain at this point. Why does it always rain right after an immediate disaster where there's remote access needed? I swear this happens every time.
What else could go wrong?
It's like blue skies, plane crashes, now it's torrential rain, monsoon season, you may never get in there. What? Every time. This was no exception, and debris was spread over 3 miles. Various planes and organizations managed flyovers, but there were no apparent survivors and nowhere to land a helicopter, so they retreated until morning. They worked through the night to set up things like helicopter landing pads made out of bamboo in a, quote, makeshift village that was 39 miles away, so they'd be ready to set out first thing in the morning. They had law enforcement, nearly 1,000 search vehicles, 37 helicopters, and like 8,000 people ready to roll. 160 rescue workers congregated in a middle school nearby to plan and work through the night so they could try to reach the crash site as soon as the sun rose. So, again, if I'm even going to sort of repeat that allegation that we offered and they wouldn't let us kind of thing, I do want to counter that with the fact that nobody was sitting on their hands here, as far as I can tell. Like, they wanted to get there. They couldn't get there. I really don't think anybody thought there were survivors. It's messy. So make of that.
It's also the 80s.
It is also the 80s, yes. No one knew that there were survivors. 20 to 50 passengers survived initial impact. And almost all of them died of exposure, shock, or potentially treatable injuries while they waited for rescue. There's a lot of wind here. It's a lot of ambience. I don't know what to do about it. It's very loud. I don't know what to do about it. Like, there may be something I can do to stop the wind. I just haven't thought of it yet. So out in the wreckage, Yumi fell asleep. She was still stuck in her row. Check the content warnings, everybody. Night passed. When she woke up in the morning, she heard a helicopter. She tried to get their attention. She didn't succeed, so she fell asleep again. She was going through it. She is stuck still, like I said, in her row. Her arm and pelvis are both broken. So there's not a whole lot she can do but wait.
Right.
Wait to die, wait to live, wait for an absolution that will never come. Definitely seems like the vibe here. I don't think that's even inappropriate because that is clearly the situation out here. When help finally arrived, it was in the form of rescuers who had climbed the mountain for hours and 70 paratroopers being lowered on ropes from helicopters. And they made it there at 10 a.m. the next day. Plane had crashed 7 p.m. the night before. They found a horrific sight. Hundreds and hundreds of bodies, parts of bodies, fires everywhere, twisted metal further than the eye could see, and no survivors. At first. Then they saw Yumi's hand. In her recollection, she woke up to a rescuer yelling, "You're all right now," and pulling her out of the row she was trapped in. But some part of her barely conscious brain must have still been fighting for a chance because rescuers said that they saw her waving from the wreckage, just her hand. So they did pull her out of there. There wasn't much good news to be found at the crash site. There was very little hope, and initially Yumi appeared to be the sole survivor. But after they found her, they found two more who had been seated at the back of the plane with her. 34-year-old mom named Hiroko and her 8-year-old daughter, Mikiko. They had spent the night trapped between the bodies of their other family members. And that's all I'm going to say about that, because it is just too awful.
Yeah.
The mom had fought for consciousness while her daughter told her to stay awake or she'd die, so she did. Mikiko talked her through the whole night, keeping her awake and fighting, and Hiroko believes that's why she survived. When they looked more, they also found a 12-year-old girl named Kiko hanging from a tree, but alive. She had also been seated in the back of the plane with Yumi and the mother and daughter. She had traveled with her parents and sibling. She'd survived, but she was an orphan now. News that there were survivors found was passed to the families desperately waiting for news and believing it to have been a total loss, but it was agonizingly false hope for 520 families because there were only 4 survivors. 2 women and 2 girls, all seated in the back of the plane. Recovery of the bodies and wreckage took weeks. All that was ever able to be found from the captain was fragments. So the U.S. sent investigators. The perspective officially was that 747s were in use everywhere, so understanding what had gone wrong was everybody's problem and everybody's business. Investigators thought it was a bomb at first, but as they combed through the wreckage and, more importantly, the maintenance records, they slowly put together the truth. And it wasn't until Yumi's testimony about the initial survivors and subsequent autopsies that it was widely known that there had been others who were lost because the rescue was so delayed. Japanese government apparently really did not want to acknowledge that, the ones who died waiting, and they really resisted owning anything to do with that. They disputed claims that dozens of initial survivors could have been saved with timelier rescue, saying that the victims all, quote, suffered from total bruise, brain damage, or bursting of internal organs, resulting in instantaneous or near instantaneous death. And the autopsies for all victims listed their times of death as the moment of impact, which we know from Yumi that is definitively not true. So the U.S. NTSB assisted in the investigation and eventually concluded that, quote, the crew did all they could, but the crash was inevitable, end quote. They concluded that from the time of the bulkhead failure, things played out more or less the only way that they could have. Quote, investigators arranged a series of simulator tests with representative crews to see if a safe landing could have been made, given the same failures which occurred on Flight 123. even without all the extra noise, the lack of oxygen, and the fear of death, and with some foreknowledge of the nature of the emergency, none of the five crews in the experiment were able to land the plane. All eventually abandoned attempts to line up with the runway and chose to ditch in Tokyo Bay instead, and one got to 30 feet above the water with wings level, a relatively sedate descent of 500 feet per minute, and a speed of just under 200 knots. But at that speed, there was no way to flare for touchdown, and the plane would surely have cartwheeled on impact with the water and suffered a catastrophic breakup, resulting in widespread fatalities. It was thus considered that the crew of Flight 123 never had any chance of making a safe landing. They were doomed from the moment the bulkhead failed. End quote.
They literally did everything they possibly could do.
Everything. So airline retired Flight 123. Crash hit their bottom line hard. One article said that airline employees were assaulted, spit on, and yelled at if they appeared in public in their uniforms. Which is, fuck that. That's, God, that pisses me off.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Listen, I understand aiming that kind of anger at the company, the corporation. Go for it. But
even at that, we're talking about airline, but it was Boeing that dropped Boeing had the plane.
It was because Japan Airlines, if you remember, they didn't have the expertise to fix this, so they contracted a Boeing team.
Yes.
I will say that Japan Airlines, they didn't catch it on any future inspections or anything like that, but it was hidden.
Right.
Yeah, it really kind of was more on Boeing, but we will actually get to that in a moment because there's a theory about that.
I feel like maintenance can only do so much.
Yes. So this bulkhead, I didn't include this, but I remember it. The bulkhead was actually designed to last longer than the plane itself. So the point where the bulkhead would basically have problems due to age was long after the plane itself would have had problems due to age. So they didn't check it that closely.
Because that makes sense.
It shouldn't have been aging naturally at a point that, you know, to a point that was a problem. But of course, it wasn't aging naturally. It had a huge reconstruction. The airline agreed to give $7.6 million, that's translated to U.S. dollars, to the families, but they refused to admit wrongdoing. That is the equivalent of about $22 million today, which, with that many families, honestly, not that much.
No.
Boeing did take the opportunity to make quite a few changes. Quote, using a retired short-range 747, it pressure-tested the bulkhead by repeatedly pressurizing and depressurizing it. The company's findings led them to request that all passenger 747s undergo a visual inspection of the aft side of the bulkhead every 2,000 flight cycles. Then the company doubled down, recommending that mechanics use x-rays or ultrasonic waves to inspect the rear side of the bulkhead every 4,000 flight cycles once a plane completed 20,000 flights. Boeing also reinforced the aft pressure bulkheads on future planes by adding a cover plate to the bulkhead's center and what Purvis calls super tear straps, end quote.
It's just bananas that this plane went through surgery and now they're recommending x-rays. Like,
it really is.
Right.
That's a lot. I mean,
humanizing these big metal machines, and it makes me feel weird.
It is kind of weird.
I mean, necessary, but weird.
Yeah. It's unsettling. So again, content warnings. After the crash, the president of the airline resigned. And a maintenance manager who had had some responsibility for the error, as well as an engineer who had cleared the plane to fly, both died by suicide. And I believe it indicated somehow that they felt they needed to atone for their mistakes.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It is. There were charges against 20 people involved in the faulty repair, but even though it was a Japanese disaster, Boeing is an American company. So they basically said, fuck you, because in the U.S., airline employees can't be charged for this kind of thing unless it can be proven to be intentional. So it didn't happen in the U.S., but Boeing is a U.S. country. Boeing's a U.S. company, so it ended up getting dropped.
Wow.
Yeah. And this part, honestly, it feels outside of the scope of what I can have an opinion about, but it is worth noting that a lot of people believe that Boeing didn't really do anything wrong. Japan Airline was the culpable entity, but Boeing took the public and financial blame to keep Japan Airline clean because they were one of the largest buyers Boeing had.
Makes sense.
It does. It adds up. So Japan's Aircraft Accident Investigation Commission eventually issued a final verdict on the cause of the disaster, which is a little bit long, but I'll read it to you. It says the subsequent repair of the bulkhead did not conform to Boeing's approved repair methods. For reinforcing a damaged bulkhead, Boeing's repair procedure calls for one continuous splice plate with three rows of rivets. The Boeing repair technicians, however, had used two splice plates parallel to the stress crack. Cutting the plate in this manner negated the effectiveness of one of the rows of rivets, reducing the part's resistance to fatigue cracking to about 70% of that for a correct repair. The post-repair inspection by Japan Airlines did not discover the defect as it was covered by overlapping plates. During the investigation, the Accident Investigation Commission calculated that this incorrect installation would fail after about 11,000 pressurization cycles. The aircraft accomplished 12,318 successful flights from the time that the faulty repair was made to when the crash happened. Consequently, after repeated pressurization cycles during normal flight, the bulkhead gradually started to crack near one of the two rows of rivets holding it together. When it finally failed, the resulting rapid decompression ruptured the lines of all four hydraulic systems and ejected the vertical stabilizer. With many of the aircraft's flight controls disabled, the aircraft became uncontrollable. End quote. Now, an extremely brief postscript about the few survivors, which is brief for a reason. The captain's daughter was in high school when he died. She did go on to become a flight attendant for Japan Airlines. I just thought that was interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah. I really, really wanted to have some Where Are They Nows on the survivors. Now, obviously, with media being different countries, this being 30, 40 years ago, that's difficult, but I started to come across some things, and there was one. Okay, so there was an article about Yumi a year after, and it said that she wanted to return to flying, but she wasn't recovered enough yet. So I'm like, all right, well, maybe I'll find, did she return to flying? You know, is she doing okay? Anything with the other three? And keep looking. So I dug around for a little while, and I found this article that was from, I think, 5 years after it happened. And the title was something to the effect of attempt to interview survivor leads to soul searching or something. And I'm like, okay, what's this? So I click it and it's this reporter who talked about how, families and so forth had an annual gathering at the site and that he had gone there. He or she, I didn't notice. They had gone there and with
the journalist did?
Yes, the journalist had gone there with, from what I can gather, good, but journalistic hopes of interviewing one of the survivors. And that one of the survivors got there and he wanted to ask questions, but she turned around and he could just see how much extreme pain she was in. And then some of the families had kind of gotten in between them and said, leave her alone. She's been through enough. If she wanted to talk to you, she'd be talking to you. Let her live her life and heal. And I didn't find a whole lot about survivors, but I read that and I felt like that was my sign to not keep looking.
Right. Wow.
So I don't really know what became of any of them. And I wanted to look and then I came across that and looking started to feel disrespectful. So I didn't. 24 years after the accident, someone installed stairs and a handrail so visitors could access the site more safely. There are a variety of memorials. And to this day, wreckage is still being discovered, with another oxygen mask being discovered as recently as 2022, because sometimes they get dislodged by tsunamis right. and things. Wow. And that is Japan Airlines Flight 123, which I do believe continues to hold the record for most fatalities from a single plane crash, because technically 9/11 counts in those statistics, right. but that's kind of an outlier. That's kind of a different situation. Right. And there was one plane crash that technically has higher fatalities, but it was a mid-air collision between two passenger planes.
Right.
So that includes both. This is the largest from a single jet. I'm 95% sure that I believe that record still stands.
Well, that was heavy, but you covered it so well.
Thank you. I wow. love hated this episode.
It's, you know, just the images that that you sent me. And
yeah, don't Google those, guys. Yeah. Really don't. And at first, see, I started looking at this page. I don't think it was Japanese. I think it was French. It was in a different language, but I think French. And then I couldn't initially read it before I realized how to translate it, blah, blah, blah. So I'm skimming this and I'm like, oh, wow, you know, it's crash site pictures. They're not really that graphic though. And then I sent them to you. And then I start zooming in closer and I was like, what is?
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, actually, they're extremely fucking graphic. I didn't understand completely what I was seeing at first.
Yeah, probably one of the more
graphic
things I've seen since we've covered.
Yeah, I mean, there was saturation diving, but I would not recommend it. Definitely not. And there was one that for a second looked like it was a heartwarming rescue photo. It was not at all. I'm serious. I'm not just like, you know, oh, teehee, there's pictures out there, but don't go, like, really, you shouldn't.
Yeah.
Don't. I really don't think you should. Kind of wish I had not. So
I really do love the part about the journalist and just kind of like the ethics with the survivors and how you chose to.
I mean, I didn't know what to do about that because
give them privacy.
I like to have things victim-focused, and it's hard to be victim-focused when almost all of them don't survive, and the few who do, you know, if you want a victim-focused episode, you gotta find their stories. And I feel like, ethically, morally, I want victim-focused episodes, but in this case, it didn't feel right.
Sometimes you should follow your gut. I think you made the right decision.
Thank you. And I truly hope that they are doing as well as can be hoped for.
Yeah. I'm definitely going to need some disaster relief after this one.
Me too.
All right. I can go first since you have been chatting away about the most horrible thing ever.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate
that. My voice is tired.
I love TikTok. I love learning stuff on TikTok.
There's a lot to learn on there.
Okay. You know how I complain about food prep and picking dinner and it just sucks? I hate it. I hate it so much, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know on the Walmart app, like you can do like grocery pickup and all that stuff, right?
Mm.
They actually have a section with recipes in the Walmart app. You can just type in recipes. Yeah. And it's got all sorts of things. Everything you could possibly think of. I'm pretty sure they pull from different websites, you know, these mm-hmm. recipes. And so I'm like, I'm going to try it out this week. So I picked 6 different meals. You hit it and it tells you every single ingredient that's in like a standard recipe would do. But you can add it all to your fucking cart.
Dude.
And that is a game changer to me. That is a game changer. So you hit the recipe and like you can go through if you already have like the spices and stuff and take it off. But and just do grocery pickup and it's already like it's meal planned for you. You can change the number of people that are serving. I've made 5 of the meals that I picked. It was so easy. There was enough ingredients, like I had no issues except for I did get like 6 bunches of parsley, which was not needed. I'll be having parsley for the rest of my life. But the recipes are so good. I have not really? Been just yes. Yesterday I made homemade from scratch chicken and dumplings. It took about 45 minutes. What else did we have? A bunch of pasta dishes. There's like a chicken piccata recipe.
Wow.
And it's so good. And it was like cheaper than like the meal boxes that I've been trying.
I'm absolutely going to look into this.
Okay. So there's 7 people in my family. I got 6 meals and it was $250 for 6 meals, dinner meals.
Wow.
Which is cheap for us.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just hit recipes. You can go through it. Just puts it in your little shopping cart. So cool. Walmart.
I'm going to look into this. I'm intrigued for sure.
I mean, I hate to white knight for Walmart, but I'm tired. I'm a tired mom. So, yeah. What's yours?
Mine, I actually have one ready for once. I've been doing yoga. And I've been following guided yoga and meditation with the Underbelly, which is the most accessible yoga thing I have ever done. And I've done this here and there throughout the years. But my purpose now is that I am getting very, very old very, very quickly. And everything hurts.
I
am limbering up all the time. Like, I'm forever bending over and stretching my back out, trying to twist and crack the damn thing, stretching because, and like, I have been aware of stretching as a concept forever. I live on this earth, but never until the last like 2 years have I felt like stretching was something I need to actively and frequently do to maintain myself.
I heard this years ago. When you see a cat or a dog wake up, the first thing they do is stretch. Why don't we do that? Like, it's so important.
I do a lot, but I do tend to stretch when I wake up. But I've also found just that if I'm like sitting down editing or writing or researching for like an hour or two, I am all scrunched up. I need to limber my ass up because I am getting so old and so crunchy.
Do you like yoga? I've never done it.
Not overly much. Like, I've done it here and there just because it would be like an entry point to a fitness journey or something, which is not what I'm doing right now. This is a limberness and flexibility journey because I have never felt so old, which I guess is fitting because I've never been so old, but the need to build more stretching into my life has become apparent. So I hopped myself on YouTube and I started looking around and I just need a very particular vibe, I think, because I'm just not a fitnessy person. I really dislike diet culture and everything that's even adjacent to it. And I mean, yoga is not directly in diet culture, but it's probably adjacent enough for me to be a little suspicious.
Like, we're being thrown right back into the 90s. Diet culture right now is insane to me.
I'm not gonna get started on that right now.
Okay.
But I agree. And I don't know, I need a very chill, very accessible, very good energy vibe. I would love something that is it's a fat, black, and queer-owned thing, and that is important to me. And it's awesome, dude. I was following a yoga tutorial the other day, and I swear to God, I ended up cracking every bone in my body. I cracked things I didn't know I had to crack. It was better than a chiropractor.
Oh, it felt so good, I bet.
Yes, and the person who leads the yoga is built similarly to me and has the best energy and is encouraging without being like positive in a way that you don't want to deal with while you're stretching your hamstrings out. All around 10 out of 10, cannot recommend enough.
You said soft belly?
It's called the Underbelly.
The Underbelly.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that there are various things that they do. I've been doing guided yoga on YouTube, but I will probably spring for a monthly subscription because I am wondering how many times a day is too many times a day to do yoga now. And I really feel a difference in my stretchiness. I've been doing it for a couple weeks and I love it. I'm obsessed.
Well, just listen to your body. Yeah.
Yes, it's great. And I really think that our listeners would really love the Underbelly. So if you have any interest at all in that kind of thing, but you're like, I don't know, just hear me out because I really think that you will like the people. So
that's awesome.
Give it a shot. I love it.
Yeah, the only thing I know about yoga is Cosmic Kids.
I love Cosmic Kids yoga.
It's really cute.
It really is. That got me through COVID. It did. I bet they became millionaires during COVID.
I sure hope so.
Me too. They deserve it.
Oh. Well, we Shall have to pick up our kids soon.
So. We do. And I have to go to the store first. So I better go.
Or you can go to the Walmart app. I'm just kidding.
Well, I actually briefly thought about that and then looked at the clock and they would not have it ready fast enough, or I would have.
Well, until next time,
sweet dreams or no dreams.
Hey, Horrible Ghouls. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you would like to share your personal MarkSafe moment, you can send it to us at MarkSafePodcast@gmail.com. Please give our podcast a rate, review, and subscribe, and tell your buddies about us too. That goes a long way. If you want to further elevate your support, check out our MarkSafe Patreon page, where we have shoutouts, goodies, and some bonus content in the works. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again, and as always, stay safe.